Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Timmery, and I'm very excited to talk to our next guest, Matthew Stillman. How are you doing?
I'm pretty well, thanks, Timmery. Doctor?
Thank you. So your new book, Genesis Deflowered, HuffPo described it as 50 Shades of the Bible. Is that right?
That is correct. They did call it that.
So what? what exactly is your project?
So I took the King James Bible's version of Genesis, the full of these and thous, and I added text to it without taking any words away, added text to it to turn it into an erotic novel. So there's almost 500 sex scenes that were sex acts which are suggested in Genesis, but none of them are described, of all sorts, tame and not so tame. And I decided to add text in that would, but written in the same chaste, restrained, poetic way that the Bible is written in English.
So the continued with the early modern English style, mostly?
That's exactly right.
Okay. So out of the sex scenes, what was the most obviously kinky to begin with? I just want to know that right off the bat.
Well, I think right in the beginning, in the first couple pages, there is a minor character named Lamech who has two wives named Ada and Zillah. And it says, again, this part's in the Bible, it says, and one night he laid with his two wives. And in the morning, seemingly, they each have a set of twins. And so to me, that sort of seemed like, well, he's got two wives and he lays with them at once. That seems like pretty clearly a threesome.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. But, on the other end, I mean, there's some other low-hanging fruit. There's the scene with Lot and his two daughters. Ooh. Where his two daughters each seduce him and get him drunk and so they can get pregnant. So that's pretty clearly incest. And, again, that's in the Bible. Another one which I think is pretty low-hanging fruit is Abraham has his wife Sarah, and Sarah is described in the Bible as being very beautiful. And I think on five or six occasions, he says to Sarah, "You pretend to be my sister, because if we were married, I would get hurt. And then you go hang out with Pharaoh, and I'll watch you dance slash play with them." Mm-hmm. And that to me seems pretty clearly a cuckolding fetish tied in with like the fig leaf, no pun intended, of safety.
That's fascinating. So what inspired you to look at the Bible in this particular vantage and then do this? Yeah.
Oh, just everyday activity. Just like, oh yes, of course I'll do this. So I was helping a friend of mine do some research on really strange erotica. And so I was digging around in Amazon and found really obscure stuff like, I want a goblin to rape me, snowman, please impregnate me, all sorts of really out there stuff. And as I'm sure you know with Amazon, when you sort of start to look for things, it says, well, if you looked at this, you might want to look at this.
Yeah. And then the NSA shows up at your house.
And so the book that I found in sort of following down that line was this book that was an erotic retelling of Mary getting pregnant. So I read a section of the free little piece you can read of it, and it was just mortifying. I mean, on every level, it was sort of cringeworthy, embarrassing to read, terribly written, full of typos. It just was bad by every measure. But it had like almost 30 reviews, and all of them, and this is the condensed version of them, but all of them basically said, "This book really turned me on, and I felt closer to Jesus. I now understand how special a person Mary was to have this sort of connection with God." And essentially was conflating two really powerful urges that I think all humans have, which is the spiritual urge and the sexual urge. But so often they are put at war with each other, certainly in the Western world. And I thought, if this can get 30 reviews and it's absolutely horrifically written, I could do a much better job and do it in the you know, the Elizabethan English, which is, I love that language. I think it's incredibly beautiful. And the King James Bible was the Bible that I learned on when I was a kid.
That's, I mean, that's such a fascinating point that this is so clearly a Western thing too, because, I mean, we can look at many Eastern religions where sexuality and spirituality are not at all in conflict. And I mean, the Kama Sutra would be a perfect example. That's a religious text in that tradition. But to us, to Western society, those are entirely never the twain shall meet sort of areas. That's really interesting. Do you study religion generally?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I've been really interested in religious traditions broadly as cultural artifacts, and I've really been interested in comparative spiritual traditions as a self-practice for a very long time. So I've sort of been interested in, I've been an amateur, you know, biblical scholar for 20 some odd years. This book sort of hit in a lot of different places in my life that I'm interested in. And suddenly the vision became clear and I just started writing it.
And did you envision all of the sex scenes yourself? Were any of them drawn from other ideas or other source material? Did you just have to come up with all of it from?
I came up with all of it, but I didn't take any of the words away. So I didn't want to change the arcs of the stories and suddenly like make it into something that wasn't really sort of built into the text already. So what I had to do was, you know, if it's obvious, it's obvious. The thing with, you know, with Lot's two children, two daughters, it says in the Bible that they seduced him and to get pregnant because they were afraid that the world was over and they were supposed to get pregnant. So that was what I did. I just sort of described what happens there. So that part was easy. The harder part is sort of start to tease out little bits of characters and to see what story is there, and then if that's true, then what else is true. So an example of that is, you know, everyone knows about Joseph and his technicolor dream coat, of course, right? So here's a guy who's wearing a coat, which no other piece of clothing is described at all in the Bible. And then you may not remember or know, but Joseph is sold as a slave and ends up serving a guy named Potiphar, who is second in command to Pharaoh. And Potiphar's wife is said in the Bible to admire Joseph because he's very beautiful and commands him to sleep with her. And he says, again in the Bible, I belong to my Lord, who's Potiphar. So this is interesting. Who is this guy who loves a coat, refuses to sleep with a really powerful woman, and says he belongs to his master? Well, that's a gay guy, which, you know, that's fine. But so if that's true, how else is the story of Joseph and the people around him different? And so making another tiny example, and this is a character no one's heard of in the Bible at all. But there was one in the Bible, in Genesis, there's a long list of, and this person begat this person, and he ruled over these people, and this person begat that person, and they ruled over these people. And that's easy to just sort of glance over and just be like, this section is boring. Nothing is happening here. But in one particular line in one of those lists, there's a woman by the name of Mehatabel, and normally they're just naming men. And it says in that list that she ruled with her husband. And so I'm like, well, that's interesting. What does that mean? Why is this one woman mentioned? Why is she unusual? And while there's not a lot of information about Mehatabel, there is this sense like, oh, wow, well, if she rules sometimes and he rules sometimes, is this sort of like a dom-sub relationship? Is this, and, you know, that's, you can take a look in the book and find out what's there. But it's trying to find little details and characters and see if that can be teased out into a larger sexual world.
And it sounds like you were given, like, a bizarrely large number of opportunities for that, because this is basically the first... I mean, this is just entirely Genesis?
This is just Genesis.
Just Genesis. And there were hundreds of sex acts.
Yeah, there's almost 500 suggested sexual acts, you know, in Genesis. It's filthy.
I went to Catholic school.
The best possible ways.
We had to read all this stuff, but I feel like incredibly cheated because we didn't get to focus on this stuff nearly enough. There was a lot of whitewashing of, like, there was an awful lot of focus on very specific scenes, and there was there was a lot of, you know, like at most you might get that very controversial conversation about David and what was his deal with Jonathan.
Right, Jonathan,
and,
yeah.
You know, that sort of conversation, which, you know, some folks would be like, shut it down. But, you know, in reality, I mean, there is the entire Song of Songs. I mean, this is not ultimately a super prudy book.
No, it's not at all. It sort of has been seized by religious folks who have a hard time coping with making sex and religion / spirituality be friends with each other. So it does get smoothed out, but it's absolutely there. I'm convinced that people who were reading this or hearing the stories of the time would have understood some of the subtleties that were there. I mean, just as another small example, whenever feet or heels are mentioned in the Bible, it's split about half and half between that meaning feet or meaning genitals. So, and this is, you know, there's nothing controversial about this. Like, biblical scholars agree that that was sort of a turn of phrase that people use because they wouldn't want to actually say, you know, penis. They just wouldn't say it, or vagina for that matter. So they used heels. So what does that mean? So if someone is washing someone's heels or, you know, standing by their heels, like, well, that adds a sexual element to what seemed like before just a boring foot washing scene.
Hmm. I see. Do you go into the dilemma of where the hell all of Adam and Eve's children came from?
Well, you know, I've certainly thought about it, but to me, that is not a really big problem in the sense that the Bible doesn't, even itself, doesn't claim to be a complete history of everything that happened ever. It's a complete history of what they consider to be most important. Hmm. So, you know, to me, it's the extra characters are like background characters in your favorite television show. Like, they come and go, they appear out of nowhere, but you're really following the main line of the main character. So, to me, I didn't worry about that too much.
Fair enough.
But there are little things, like it says Cain married a woman. Well, where does she come from? I don't know. But it was important to give her a name that she was a real person. I mean, one of the things about there not being, you know, these 500 sex scenes or suggested sexual acts is that no women initiated any of them, which seems impossible. And so part of what I was doing in the book was I wanted to give women sexual agency and to show that they had desires, pleasure, interest in sex, and which is possible to bring out without changing the stories at all.
That's interesting. So the fact that you use the King James Version versus other translations, does that make any difference?
Well, I mean, to me, there's a couple things. The first is that I love the language of that, and I think it's sort of, it's really poetic and really beautiful. And whether people can read it easily or not, there's so much of that particular version of the Bible which is trapped in our everyday parlance. Just so many phrases which you think are just like regular phrases are just pulled straight out of there. So there is some sort of valuable cultural historicity which I'm interested in. The other thing is that, you know, and so I wanted to be able to write in that style. The second thing is that it's in public domain, and more modern versions, while I would be altering them, there could be theoretically be a claim pushed against me for not doing enough change to it, and then I'm violating a copyright. But I was actually, my first instinct was to do it with the King James Bible anyway.
And how about like earlier versions?
Like the William Tyndale version?
Yeah.
You know, that is a little bit too obscure. Okay. And it really reads very, very differently.
Okay.
You know, the thing about the King James is that while it may not be at the front of people's minds, it sort of, it exists in the culture. So at least there was a place for it. And the William Tyndale version, which I've read, is just really like an even older form of modern English. And it's even harder to read.
So then it would be like, I'm trying to imagine what a sex scene would sound like from, I don't know, let's just say like pre-modern English, so something like Middle English. Like, how?
Well, there are examples. I mean, but I wasn't going to go, I wanted this to at least be readable. I mean, this is as readable as a Shakespeare play, which is, takes a little bit of attention, but not unreadable.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we discussed the kinkiest stuff. So was there anything that was just like, you know, fairly vanilla, chill, like that was very obviously that sort of thing, and so it expanded that way in your version?
Oh yeah, I mean, there's some really beautiful, simple scenes that are just delicate and pretty, which again start from being a very simple, pretty place in the Bible, but you know. Isaac and his wife Rebecca have they just talk in the Bible again and again, like how much they love each other and how attentive they are and how much they serve each other over the years. And so that leads to just really simple. And we also talk about them having sex when they're really old. And so what is an old person who has really tender, loving sex with someone who they've loved their entire lives? What is that like? And to be able to describe that, there's nothing kinky about it, except for the fact that it's intimated in the Bible, and I sort of fleshed it out more.
And it's a type of sexuality that is absolutely real and totally underrepresented.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that's important, and one of the nice things I've gotten in response from some religious people who've read it is that it makes them feel like that they have sort of a spiritual sexual role model now, because it's suddenly they see, and you know, I work really hard to make the text seem almost in that it slips right into the original. You can't always tell where my text begins and the Bible ends. So I had, again, some religious people say, I suddenly feel good about some of the choices that I've made, because I see that Abraham did it, that Sarah did it, that Rebecca did it, that Joseph did it. You know, I recently was in touch with a former priest who is gay, who was in tears saying that he was just so touched by my depiction of Joseph being sort of like an honorable, regular gay man who has loving relationships and helps other gay men with their relationships.
That's a really interesting question about the... So assuming someone is religious and believes the original King James text to be, you know, accurate depiction of their religious beliefs. Is there a conflict there? Is it immediately you're going to be like, oh yes, this is exactly all the stuff I already believe, plus also the goodies? Are there people that are having difficulty with it? What is the reaction from folks who are religious?
Well, there's been a range. I mean, I of course have gotten some, as you might expect, some hate email and hate Twitter about, you know, that you can't, you know, screw around with the words of God and where do you get off. On Friday, someone spray painted on the front of my house the word blasphemy, but they spelled it wrong, which was awesome.
Sorry. of course it is. Of course it's misspelled. Of course it is.
Of course it's misspelled. So, I called the police first and the press second. So we'll see if that helps at all. But of course, there has been some pushback. And those are squeaky wheels. So there's that. But I've again, been touched by people's who are religious response saying, I realize that you are essentially trying to make a point here, and using it on sort of the ground that I'm most familiar with, so they're willing to read it. Those people tend to be religious, but maybe not super doctrinaire, while they may consider themselves Christian or Jewish. So the response from those sorts of people has been good. But there have been people who are atheists who love it because they consider it like a thumb in the eye to religion and consider it a fun way to actually read the Bible finally. And I've also had, you know, religious feminists say that it's like a really important text because it gives women agency and it speaks to their desires and gives them voice and gives them names where they haven't had any. So I think religious people have met it in different ways, which is shocker, you know, the way you would imagine it, because people are different.
And it's sort of technically a queering of the original text, just the idea that, you know, you go back to something that has already existed, some art, something in the culture that has already existed, and review it through a lens of outside of the traditional hegemonic viewpoint. And
that's exactly right, yeah.
So from that perspective, it's like sort of a radical thing, it's sort of a political act, but ultimately it's incredibly conservative because, I mean, the book itself is full of sex. I mean, sex and violence are really the biggest parts of content in there. When I
Those are the two threads that run through, two of the maybe three or four main threads that run through Genesis, to be sure.
So, I mean, the thing that would be objectionable, I'm just trying to be empathetic to someone who would be who would find this blasphemous. The objection that I can only think of is like, what if you got it wrong? You know, like, what if she actually really wasn't into that? Or what if he really was way more kinky than that? Or like, you know, like, how do you decide which sex acts are okay, given that the book itself says, which not necessarily Genesis says, but that the Old Testament says which sex acts are more okay than others? Like, how do you choices?
Yeah, I think the way that the people get to the feeling that this is blasphemy is that the way the Bible wrote it is all that needs to be said about it. Hmm. And you can think about it however you want about it afterwards, but if you're not thinking about this in the most conservative of ways, in the sense that the words that are there are all that need to be there, then you're thinking too far. But I'm not trying to pass this off as the original Bible, which is why I gave it a different name. If I was, you know, trying to say, here's a new translation of Genesis, like, maybe you could make that statement. But, you know, I'm an artist.
Well, and the whole thing is sort of ludicrous in general, because most of the biblical scholars that I have heard discuss this are of the opinion that the King James is probably the least accurate translation.
It is. I mean, it's not that wildly inaccurate, but of course, I mean, the scholarship has moved on so much, and the original texts have been found and been clearer. So some of the more modern translations, probably from maybe 200 years ago to maybe up to 50 years ago, are perhaps much better, but aren't nearly as beautiful in my mind, and haven't impacted the culture in the same way.
Well, that's absolutely undeniable. So are you planning on doing this with any of the other books of the Bible? Because it obviously has more sex in it.
Oh, yeah. I'm working on Exodus Deflowered now, and that is a bloody mess. I mean, God, there's so many blood-soaked orgies in that. I mean, it's crazy. But my I would love, as long as there continues to be some response to it, I'd love to keep on ticking forward and work through as much of the Bible as people will read. But I think it makes for fascinating writing and research, and people, again, have liked some of the things that I've tipped my hat towards as I've talked to people about it. So people say, like, oh, make sure you get in Samson and Delilah, and what happens with Ruth and Naomi? I'm like, I'll get there, I hope. And, you know, the New Testament, of course, is the promised land. So, you know, when you get to working with Jesus, that's when the real blasphemy starts, I suppose.
Oh, wow. That's when you're going to start getting that Reza Aslan sort of backlash. You're going to go, like, super famous just because they're so mad at you sort of territory.
Fingers crossed.
So, speaking more on just, like, the history of sex and religion, why is there this division of... you know, it's so clearly in the text, and then we can't actually, like, flesh it out. Where is that coming from? What is that about?
I would make the case that religion, that Western religion, is part and parcel with literacy and agriculture. And when you start to get literacy and agriculture combining into a location and into a culture, they start to have monotheism. And when monotheism rises, you start to create issues of social control, because you have issues around land ownership, which isn't an issue in non-literate cultures. No one owns any land. And so when you start to get into social control, you start to get into issues around sex, issues around paternity, issues around proper relations, so that you start to have a structured hierarchy, which makes sense in this world. So I think that there wasn't sort of like a malicious evil plot for people to tap their fingers and say, "Mwahaha, we're going to make people, you know, cut off themselves from their bodies and ignore sex." It really was built as a system to help people understand these are the limits in this new world that we live in. And it ended up sort of snowballing and turning into a world that ended up cutting people off from their bodies, ignoring the desires of women, because literacy and agriculture changed the way we looked at the world and our relationship with it.
Interesting. Do you consider the possibility of doing this with any other religious texts?
I mean, I sort of in jest, I thought I could do the Book of Mormon. Just so easy. I have thought about it, but I sort of feel like in terms of broad religious, I've read the Quran a number of times, but the Quran doesn't really have like a strong story element. I mean, it has stories in it, but it doesn't have a really strong story element. And I think part of what makes this fun to write and to read is that sex is a humanizing act. I don't know if you ever have, but I certainly have. If you've ever seen people have sex in real life, you really see their humanity. And the characters in the Bible are almost like mythological. We just sort of know that they stand for goodness and they stand for purity, but we don't actually see them have like a range of human experiences. And what some of the responses that I've got from some religious people and other people is that this really makes the Bible's characters seem like real people. So in another tradition and other spiritual traditions to write this, you know, I've read the Ramayana, I've read parts, huge sections of the Mahabharata, but they're pretty sexual already. So I could do it, but I think that there's probably more fruit and fodder and interest in just doing the Christian Bible / Jewish Christian Bible.
And it's, again, it's also just a very interesting point about how, and perhaps, I don't know if this is a Western belief or a modern belief or what, but that the idea that for a character, for a person, for a figure to be considered respectable, to be considered a source of moral inspiration, they have to be desexualized.
And yeah, that's exactly right.
If you see them naked or if you see them fucking, then somehow that takes away whatever work they have done, whatever knowledge they have, whatever power they possess to inspire things is somehow damaged. And that's, what is that about?
Yeah. I mean, it. Some of our most, you know, Martin Luther King and Gandhi, two incredible people, both coming from different religious spiritual traditions, are both sort of seen as like, you know, these iconic saints. But both of them had really fucked up relationships with sex and with women.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from their traditions, which distorts the relationship that we have to sex, to pleasure, to our bodies. That we're constantly trying to say, like, I'm not the body. The body is sinful. We need to cast this off. And, you know, the stories about Martin Luther King and women and prostitutes are legion. And Gandhi was known to sleep naked next to naked boys and girls to resist temptation. And that's, like, crazy. Like, what's going on with that? This is someone who's really like having a deep internal battle, and they may have an incredible sense of justice and rightness and about colonialism and how to free the world, but they are still at war with themselves with a very primal basic instinct, which is, how do I be in touch with my body and my desires? And there's no outlet for that in society. Therefore, they had to come out in a distorted, strange way like that.
And it's also a matter of, if we maintain that dichotomy, then the moment somebody learns about, you know, Martin Luther King's, let's say his affairs, for instance, then somehow that takes away the power of everything he contributed to the civil rights movement.
Because we have this
silly notion that you can't have sexual behavior and then, like, not... Yeah, it's... Yeah, we're on the same page.
We agree on this. Yeah.
So specifically Genesis Deflowered, is it out now? Is it available? Can we buy it?
You can buy it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Kobo or Sony Play. I mean, you can Google Play. You can get it at all your online retailers. You can buy paperbacks on Amazon, but it's available as an ebook for your Kindle or for your EPUB, you know, version for your Nook, whatever you want. You can get it.
That's fantastic. And where can people learn more about you and your other
stuff? I write about creativity at my website, stillmansays.com.
That's awesome. So any other things that you would like people to take away just from this entire project, from the experience of doing it?
One thing which the influence that the Bible has had culturally is so massive, and it influenced, you know, English writing from when it first came out. And so something that I worked really hard on was to write in Elizabethan English, and that, which is not easy to do. So I had an amazing editor named Veronica Tuggle, who I highly recommend as like an amazing person, but also as a great editor, who just happened to be an expert in Elizabethan style grammar, but really worked on reading lots of poetry, erotic, romantic, love poetry from 1612 all the way through the mid-1800s, and wanted to find like little fragments of beautiful things, lines, phrases, turns of phrase, rhymes, and put them into the Genesis to Flower that I had written to sort of imagine if this was the original text, how would it have affected literature and poetry for the next 300 years? And so I think that adds to the book feeling beautiful and poetic and sort of sweeping, that it has all those things built into it. But I think that you can read the book in lots of levels, though. You can read it from a literary perspective, from a cultural perspective. You know, if it turns you on to masturbate to, you know, giants having sex with regular sized people, that's in the Bible. But if you just want to sort of have like a new take on thinking about your religion and sex, this can meet you there too.
What if a cult pops up as a result of this? How do you feel about that?
I'm ready to talk to them.
Sweet. So if anyone's inspired to go start their own little services where these things are reenacted, you contact Matthew Stillman.
And he will show up. You can find me on Twitter. You can email me. I'm totally happy to talk about it.
That's awesome. So someone should go do that. So thank you very much, Matthew. This has been incredibly entertaining and edifying. So everybody go check out Genesis to Flowered on all of the places. It's everywhere, evidently. So yes. Thank you, Matthew.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Doctor.
And thank you, everyone, for listening, and have a great day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.